Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and joining Simon and I today is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, it's time to spring clean your finances, starting with your pension. It's not too late to get your retirement saving plans back on track. We'll show you how. Switching is another big win for your wallet, but remember, it's not all about the money. Who are IRESA and what on earth have they done wrong? Also today, the clock is ticking to make the most of your RISA, but you better hurry. We answer a reader's query about inheritance tax and discuss the used cars that are new cars. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.
Right, spring is in the air, allegedly. A good time to take a look at our personal finances. And that starts with digging our collective heads out of the sand and staring our pensions in the face, yes. So starting with retirement savings, too many of us keep letting it slip down our priority list, but it's not too late to get it back on track. Now, it all comes as millions who are auto-enrolled face a decision later this month, or not, when contributions go up, to stick or twist, with fears many young people particularly could opt to opt out. So, a very warm welcome to you both. Firstly, let's go with the auto-enrolment, if you would, Lee. What is happening there and what are the fears?
Well, auto-enrolment is a government scheme that they started a while back now, slowly getting more and more people to automatically start paying into their pensions rather than giving people the decision and having to get the ball rolling themselves. The idea was to get people to start paying a percentage of their wage automatically, and your workplace should match that, and then you're building up a nice pot for retirement. The thing is, a lot of people hear the word pensions, especially in their 20s or when they're first starting work, and the shutters go down and they're not really too interested. So there was a whole problem with it. Didn't look like people were saving enough to retire. So auto-enrolment from next Friday, people automatically going to have their percentages that they pay of their wage into the pension go up to 3%. From 1% to 3%.
Which you might not think that's a huge amount, however.
It all depends on your circumstance, doesn't it? Because 2%, exactly. 2% of your wage could mean an energy bill. It could mean money that goes towards rent, and you might already be struggling anyway. You may want to opt out. Some people might feel like they've already built up a big enough pension pot and don't need to be paying in 3% and might want to opt back to 1%. If you can afford to do it, it is worth doing, because
you've got some research on your website saying it's a huge difference it could make to your retirement.
It's a huge leap, and actually, if you could kind of not notice it, leaving your account, it's a good scheme, really. At the heart of it, it's a good scheme. We talk about this all the time, but compound interest is your friend. Mm. So the sooner you can start building up a pot and it snowballs over your working career, the more healthier retirement pot you're going to have, and theoretically a better retirement. But actually, interestingly, next year it goes up from 3% to 5%. And now that really is a big leap from 1% to 5%. The other argument towards this, though, and this is something that does play on my mind a little bit, even as a 30-something, and you just wonder what this means for the state pension. There's all sorts of rumours of what could happen to the state pension, and you think, well, knocking up these percentages for people, sort of doing it on their behalf, it's a little bit of a worry. Back of my mind,
so you think all of these things are pointing towards the fact that we will not have a state pension?
Well, not that there wouldn't be a state pension, perhaps like a means-tested state pension or something along those lines. But, you know, this is me speculating. There's nothing that's out there. But it is a sort of way, I guess, of the government solving a bit of a pensions crisis, to be quite frank with you, because people have never had it so good, our parents and that generation, in the fact that they've got some very, very handsome pension deals that they've had, and we're never going to see the likes of those sort of gold-plated pensions again. And it's a way of getting people to save for retirement fundamentally, but yeah, there is the concerns.
Well, as Lee says, Simon, there are fears about the state pension, but it's not perhaps a bad way to think, if you are saving, that you won't have that protection when you're older, because it might spur you into acting now, which is essentially what your article is trying to get us to do, to say it's not too late, get your head out of the sand and deal with your pension.
Yes. I mean, you can't predict what's going to happen 30 or 40 years into the future. It could be that the state pension radically changes in 30 or 40 years. it could be that the age at which you get it goes up considerably faster than people think. Mm-hmm. It could be that the state pension actually gets better. There is an argument that state pension has got better due to the introduction of the flat rate state pension. Now, there's a lot of people who got caught out by this contracting out issue who were misled into thinking they were going to get this £155, £160 a week that was promised, and actually it turns out they haven't. But that's because more of their money went into private pensions and they've just got a bit of a surprise. But once that all works itself out in the wash, the state pension should theoretically be better and our pension savings should be better because these people are saving into a pension. Now, I've got some figures here that show that of the UK employees in a pension scheme, 80% or just more than 80% of professional workers have a pension that they pay into, 80% of managers, we've got about 65% of administrators, 70% of administrators, and once you shuffle down to people working in sales, just below 60%, and for caring and leisure, that's just above 60%. Now, really, that's quite surprising, isn't it? That's much higher than I would have thought it was, but that is down to auto-enrolment. There is two issues here. One, it's better to have some money in a pension than none. And I remember being at a talk where someone explained this very clearly, someone who'd been involved in the architecture of auto-enrolment. He said, to those of people at the top of the finance game, you know, working in the industry, the idea of a £4,000 a year pension that you've got from your auto-enrolment money sounds like hardly anything at all. But once you break that down, and you've got someone who's getting an extra £350 a month, if they're relying on what is now £160 a week state pension, then £350 a month actually makes a material difference to them. If you're at the bottom end of the scale, £4,000 a year, £2,000 a year even an extra £100 a month will make a difference to you. So that's why it's important to get people paying into pensions. And that's why auto-enrolment has been a success, because people are building up pensions. But the problem is that we've got 60% of people working in customer services, for example, who now have a pension, but they probably don't have enough in it.
Yeah.
They need more in it.
And even when it goes up next year, so not even this rise, the next one people are saying is not going to be enough, 8%?
No. Realistically, there's a lot of different figures bandied around for this and a lot of different rules of thumb. You probably want to be paying about 15% of your earnings into a pension. That's a lot. That's a lot if you're really struggling to get by.
And you want to get a house.
If you can just get 10% in there, then that's great. And this is where the employer contributions come in, as Lee said.
So your personal would be 10% is what you're saying.
If auto-enrolment is forcing you to put in 5%, then if you've got an employer that will put in 5% as well, then you're hitting at least 10%. And that's great. But the best way to save for a pension is A, to start as early as possible. So there's this wonderful thing involved in compounding that means that if you save a certain amount for 30 years or you save the same amount for 40 years, over that last 10 years, you double your money. You get twice as much money. That's why don't turn down the opportunity to save into a pension in your 20s. The other thing is, if someone said to you, you're going to have £50 a month, go out of your wages into your pension, you might go, I can't really afford £50. Things are a bit tight. If someone said to you, you give me £50, I'll give you £112.50. You'd say, okay, sounds like a pretty good deal. So £50, you pay £50 into a pension. If you're lucky, your employer matches it. They pay £50 into a pension, and then you get £12.50 basic rate tax relief, which boosts you back up to where you would have been before you were taxed on that money. So you're getting £112.50 going into your pension in return for £50. And one of the great advantages of a pension is its disadvantage. Yeah. You can't get that money until you are 55, and that number's going to go up. But because you can't get that money, it means that it's just there, invested for the long term, growing and growing and growing and growing.
So this goes back, Simon, just briefly, auto-enrolment. Lots of fears that people might opt out when they do rise. But I guess the beauty of it, again, is our old friend behavioural economics.
Yes. What we're doing is nudging people into pensions. Instead of offering them a chance to opt in, we're offering them a chance to opt out. And there's a whole raft of evidence that shows that people don't tend to opt out. Obviously, the real test is when it becomes a slightly more noticeable sum from their salary. But if you are saving into a pension, investing into a pension, what can you do? Well, you can check whether you're on track, and then you can go to work on it to try and do some things that mean you'll end up with more at that point.
So the first thing is, what have you got? Find your old pensions. There's a service you can use, is that right, Lee?
Yeah, you can track down your old pensions. Actually, we get quite a lot of emails about tracking down your old pensions, but there is actually...
Well, they're asking you to track it down.
Yeah,
for them.
No, there are, but it's actually, there's quite a good scheme, because at last count, there was £3 billion worth of unclaimed savings where people get confused, perhaps move between jobs, don't know where their pension pot's gone, and might not have the paperwork, might have moved house. Lots of things now, obviously, electronic, and we get things emailed and whatnot. But, you know, not that long ago, it would have just been purely paperwork, and you might not have had an online account and that sort of thing. So what you can do is you can write to the Pensions Tracing Service, which is mentioned in the story, based in Wolverhampton, and you can also use an online service, and there's also a telephone number you can phone up. So you've got three methods there of tracking down an old pension, but it's worth doing, because you might have built up and it might have grown in value. Sometimes, though, what happens in some of these legacy pensions is that fees have sadly eaten away at the money, which is a good point to say. It's sometimes worth just rolling it into one.
Well, this is it, right? So if you do find you've got, I think I've got four, although I'm going to double check. And that's the nature, isn't it, of the way that we work now. You move around different companies. I may have more than four. Mm-hmm. Is it worth me looking at pooling it all together at the moment or not? Simon?
Maybe.
Okay, that's
so
not useful.
From a behavioural point of view, okay?
Yeah.
Which actually... you may find is the most important. If you pull them all together, you will be able to see all of that money in one place. You will be able to, once you've pulled them all into one under one umbrella service, you'll be able to invest them all into the same place, for example. So you can see all your investments in one go. You might be invested in a couple of funds. You might just choose one, you know, big tracker fund. And you're more likely to engage with it, and you're more likely to keep an eye on it. And the very act of pulling your pensions together, the fact that you have done that work and you have signed up to a service and you know where they are and you know how to check on them, makes it substantially more likely that you're going to stay engaged with that pension, because you've already engaged with the pension once. Cost-wise, potentially yes, potentially no, because what you tend to find is work pensions schemes tend to be pretty cheap. The employer effectively kind of subsidises some of it. You're pooling your pension with an awful lot of other people, so there's an economy of scale. So pension providers will offer firms institutional rates, which tend to be lower in terms of the management of that pension. So the wrapper that goes around that pension, you probably find that the fund charges are pretty much the same. If you leave your job, you might find that those charges stay the same for people who have left the company. But you might find, and this is the thing that you really need to check up on, that those charges have gone up. So some schemes, you'll find that you've got one rate while you're a member of the company, and then after you've left and gone to work for another company, they no longer feel the need to, you know, help you out, subsidise you, offer you this economy of scale, and you start paying more. In that instance, it's probably worth you moving your pension. If you're lucky and you've got some company where the charges are super low, then on a cost basis, it might be worth staying where you are. But again, you then need to look at what's the cost of the pension service that you're moving into. Some of them are more expensive, but they offer more bells and whistles and help in investing. You might want that. Some of them are very cheap, and they offer the ability to invest for what is effectively a very, very small amount of money. And if you've got a very big pension pot, it might be worth going with somewhere that charges a flat fee rather than a percentage of the amount of money you've got, because that would work out cheaper. But I would go back to the argument that actually pulling all your pensions together, as long as you don't lose out on any special benefits, because some of these old-fashioned like life insurance pensions and things like that, is probably going to be a benefit in the long run, because you're going to be much more engaged with it.
So it's not about being materially beneficial. It's not like you're going to get more out of it, etc. necessarily, but it just means that you're not going to have a situation where you might forget you've got some, or just not get involved.
Yeah, you're not necessarily going to benefit on cost, although there's quite a strong chance that you might do, but you are probably going to benefit on levels of engagement and just knowing where they all are. Think about, like, how often do you check things that you're meant to check? Your bank balance, check how much your energy bills were, check your pension, check your ISA and things like that. Probably not quite as much as
we're
you should do.
We're quite sad, so in this studio we probably don't quite often, I imagine.
No, exactly. So we're skewing way more towards what you're meant to be doing kind of thing. But then look at the thing where you've got four of them. How often are you going to check then?
Oh, I tell you what, you can't... Remembering the passwords for those is a nightmare. But I do would like to say I've got one pot that I didn't know I had. It's probably only got a couple of grand in it, but I liked having it in this souped up, super risky, I didn't even know I had it anyway, let's just go nuts account. I'd be quite reluctant to put that in sort of like a nice one. I'm quite enjoying the fact it's doing really badly at the moment because it's so exposed.
But you've just told me that you are engaged with that pension. You know where it is. You know what it's doing.
Yeah.
You know it exists. You've basically, as I said, you've just skewed massively to the upside on the engagement levels. Even if you're behaving financially irresponsibly, which, yeah. Georgie, you know, to be fair, it's a long time until you're going to retire.
Do you know what I mean?
So you can afford to take that risk.
Exactly, and there really is nothing in it.
As long as it's not all in, like, smaller company gold mining shares or something.
Bitcoin. No, it's not. So, okay, the first thing then to do is take a look at what you've got. Pull it all together if that's useful for you, if you're not someone who's particularly engaged. And then what?
Well, it's always helpful to know where you're going. Work out what that pot and what the amount of money you're saving every month now is going to theoretically get you in the future and how that compares to what you want. You're not going to get a precise verdict on this, but you're probably going to be able to get a decent approximation. Your pension company will probably have written to you and given you some information.
But what does that number mean? How much should you be having? Some people say a third of what you get, half of what you get.
Yes, I've not had any letters that say blah, but they might as well say blah, because I got one from my pension provider the other day that told me the value of my pot.
Yeah.
As of the 6th of April 2017.
Yeah, same, yeah.
Yes, that's great. We're meant to be getting people to engage with pensions, and they've sent me a valuation of my pension, which is basically almost a year old. And I almost didn't notice, and I suddenly saw the date at the top. My poor wife then had to listen to me rant for about 20 minutes.
I did exactly the same thing. I had obviously the same lesson through. And then I thought, God, that's not very high. What have I done wrong? Is it been like, it was a great year's performance, by the way, percentage-wise. But then I realised it was from a year ago. And then I ranted. And she just looked at me like cluelessly, like, what on earth are you going on
my
about?
My little souped up pot would probably be higher a year ago. So I quite enjoy that. It'd be rubbish now.
So going back to getting ourselves back on track, about getting our pensions
sensible.
On track. Right, so how much do you need? Well, you're probably not going to need as much in retirement as you are earning in work. If you are in the fortunate position, which lots of people will be, of owning a home and having a mortgage that will end before your retirement age, you can take that mortgage payment out of there. Then there's all the ancillary costs involved with going to work, commuting, which costs some people a small fortune, and eating lunch from Marks and Spencer, which costs some people almost as much as commuting, and all these other things. So broadly speaking, if you wanted a pretty comfortable retirement, you'd be looking at 2/3 of your employment income. Most people could probably be pretty happy on considerably less. Obviously, it depends on your income and how spendy you are, which gave a figure that someone would need roughly £18,000, retired couples a year on average, to cover household essentials. And that rises to £26,000 when allowing for extras such as holidays and leisure activities. And obviously, this is going to depend on where you live, how expensive your life is, and quite how flash those holidays and leisure activities are. But you've got that figure. What you want to do then is use some kind of pension calculator. Fortunately, This Is Money has one at thisismoney.co.uk/pension calculator.
I'm on it at the moment.
You can plug in your details. You can plug in how old you are. You can plug in what you earn. You can plug in how much you're paying into your pension. You can plug in your current pension pot. And then you can adjust how much you would like to have as a percentage of your earnings in retirement. And also you can indicate how adventurous or cautious you are as an investor. It will then do some calculations. Those calculations will show you how much as a percentage of your future income you should probably get. And it uprates it to take account of wage inflation over that period of time. So it gives a realistic approximation. What it does is it uses some underlying calculations based on Fidelity, who powers it. They're experts number crunching. So they've got investment projections, and then there's a projection for how much money that pot's going to be able to deliver you. Now, one thing it is worth mentioning is that the underlying assumptions there are cautious. What they don't want to do is tell people they're going to be much better off than they are. And it gives a, if the market performs on average and if the market performs poorly figure, what it doesn't do is give it if the market performs well figure. So I'm an optimist. My glass is half full.
Good.
So I like to think that I'm going to do better than average and that hopefully things are going to be better when I retire and you're going to be able to get a better income from the same amount of money. I plugged in the numbers and I put in that I would want 60% of my earnings in retirement. I'm only going to get 37%. So I'm not quite there.
Right.
And that's if it performs on average. And if it performs poorly, I'm only going to get 21%.
So I went for 40, frugal folk that I am. If I go on market performing on average, 25%.
Yeah, probably. That's... maybe, yeah.
What do you mean, yeah, probably, maybe?
Well, I don't know. I can't see the screen that you're
so
working on.
So that means
on.
That I'm going to get 25% of my wage. That's what it's saying I'm more likely to get.
But what did you say you wanted? 40%?
Yeah.
So you're only 15% off.
Yeah, but that's still not great, is it?
No, it's not. And that shows how hard it is to save for retirement. Now, the other thing it does, though, is...
That's cautious. Oh, God.
But yeah. Things could be better. The market could do better over that period of time. It's a pretty tough time to retire now with a pot of money. You've got super low interest rates, super low annuity rates. You can't get that much out of that pot. If someone who had retired 10 or 15 years ago would have got a substantially higher income from the same amount of money. So those things are baked into that in order to not get people's hopes up too much. The interesting thing that it shows, though, is it also shows how big your projected savings pot will be. And the thing that it shows for me is even getting only 37%, not my 60% as I'd like, is I very easily bust the lifetime allowance, which is £1 million for your pension pot. And I don't think there's many people out there who realise how likely it is they're going to bust that £1 million. If you earn a reasonable amount of money, not super duper money, and you have a reasonable amount in your pension pot and you've been saving for a while and investment returns are good, there are loads of people of our generation who are going to bust that £1 million lifetime allowance. And hardly any of us think we're going to, but there will be loads of us who do. So unless that is axed or starts going up substantially, there's going to be a bit of a problem because there's going to come a point where there is no point where if that still exists or doesn't go up substantially, there will be no point me paying any more money into my pension because investment growth alone will take me over that allowance.
And there's good news in that my souped up, very adventurous pot, if I stuck it all in there, 30%.
There we go.
I'm not going to do that though. Lee, you, what happened with you?
I'll be honest with you, Georgie. I plugged the figures into the tool and I felt just a tinge of depression. I'm actually disappointed with myself that I didn't start saving for my pension a little bit earlier than I did.
Oh, don't you start.
No, but I only really properly started a couple of years ago and I'm trying to make up a little bit for lost time. And if I could go back to the start of my career when I was in my sort of early 20s, I think I would have taken it more seriously and thought about it. But you're at probably your lowest wage point and, you know, just earning money is great, especially if you've got student debt and you've got high living costs and et cetera, et cetera. But, hey.
I never look back, Lee.
Always
I never look
forward.
Back.
Always look forward,
exactly.
Georgie.
And there's going to be a lot of people in their 40s and 50s that really have nothing, right? And they don't want to be listening to this podcast and we'd be going like everybody else. Ooh! And Fidelity actually did some number crunching and said, look, it is still possible to have a reasonable sum at the end of the day, even if you're starting a little bit late. So for everyone in the 40s or 50s who are probably thinking way more than you, oh my God, why didn't I get involved years and years ago? Give them some positive news, Lee.
Well, there is some positive news. I mean, at the end of the day, you're not probably going to build up a huge pot now. Again, we're talking about the compounded interest, and that's what really starts to build it up over the years when you start early. But it's still worth saving because of the tax breaks. Also, when you reach retirement age, you drop into a lower tax band, probably, most likelihood is. So you'll save money in that respect. And also, at the moment, there's the 25% of pot you can take tax-free when you reach 55. So, you know, at the end of the day, if you're in your 40s and 50s now as well, retirement ages have pushed up. So, okay, that's on one hand incredibly depressing, but on the other hand, it gives you some extra years
unless
to...
Unless you love your job.
Unless you love your job, of course, and I'm sure lots of people out there do, as we do. It's not too late. You think about it. If you're 45, that still gives you a good 20 years to build up a pot, and especially if you're... Go back to this point again, but if your employer matches his contributions, then you should go for it. And if you can max out as much as possible I'd go for it. And just the other thing is, a lot of people treat their property as their pension. They think, oh, I've got a property, so that's my pension. And it's a dangerous game when you start playing that, I think, anyway, personally. So if you are in your 40s and 50s, it's not too late. Crunch some figures on that with our pensions calculator, how much you can afford to put in percentage wage, what your employer will match, if it will match. And you can actually, I reckon it would be as depressing reading as you think. I think you'd look at that and go, that's not a bad little nest egg for another time.
That's a bit relief. Yeah.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.
Now, it seems like the energy switching message is finally getting through. With savings of up to £300, trade body Energy UK said 660,000 of us moved supply in February, a new monthly record and 60% up on the year before. The winners, it seems, are the little guys, with around a fifth of us opting for a small or mid-tier provider. But, and while we often criticise, some might say justly so, the big six this week, you can hear their collective sighs of relief, because we got the news that one of the minnows is the ones that have been wrapped around the knuckles for basically being totally rubbish with their customers. On the review website Trustpilot, Iressa had a customer service score out of 10 of a huge 1.1 from nearly 1,000 reviews. So, Lee, who are Iressa and what on earth have they been up to?
So Iressa are one of these new wave of energy suppliers that have sort of popped up in the last few years. They're based in Nottinghamshire. And they have been topping some comparison tables for a number of years, along with other smaller providers.
Yeah.
So what's happened is, in terms of Iressa, is likelihood is they've got too big too quickly. And this is what can happen with some of these smaller providers, especially when they top the charts for, you know, price savings. And let's face it, a lot of people go, oh, that's a big saving, I'll switch them. You know, I make this point all the time. You're probably not going to get a different quality of gas or electric.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I always say. It's just a basic human need, and you want to pay.
So it comes down to money.
It comes down to
customer service.
But then
those two things.
The trouble is, when you get to a company like this, and the customer service isn't what you expected, if you need to get in touch with them for whatever reason, and it starts to fall down there, you know, there's no place to hide. People will start abusing you on websites like Trustpilot. And that actually is another good thing about the internet, is that if all it took me when I looked at this company yesterday was 2 minutes, quick Google, went on Trustpilot, saw all of these negative reviews. I've written a story. I've had a number of people get in touch. There's all sorts of billing issues by the looks of things. So,
and that's the main thing, isn't it? Billing issues generally across the board when we get complaints about energy.
Exactly. And people have been asked for like a huge one-off cost. So their energy might have been £60 a month, whatever. And then all of a sudden, they're, oh, you know, you've underpaid and we need £300. I mean, that's just not good enough, and that shouldn't
be. If you can't get through to their customer service.
And then if you can't get through to customer service. So I had a look on their social media site yesterday, Twitter. The last thing they said was during that snowy snap a few weeks ago that the call centre was struggling, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of companies were struggling. But what that seems to really cause is a huge backlog of customer complaints, emails. I've seen phone call waiting times of an hour. It's just not good enough. And if you're hanging over a looming threat of, we need £300 payment, and you want to dispute that, and you can't.
Must be
it's stress, and it's stressful, and that's exactly why you've switched away from a bigger energy supplier. You know, they may be getting you on price, but I suppose on the whole, at least they're built to cope with big customer numbers, and that's the danger. What I want to say here is that I don't want people to think that switching to a smaller supplier is necessarily going to mean these kind of problems. And you've got to do your research. It's like anything, isn't it? It's like if you compare car insurance or travel insurance, you want to make sure that you're getting the cover that you need and want, and you have to sort of do a bit of research. You can't just go, well, that's the cheapest, I'll click on that and I'll go through to that. You need to have a real look at how it's performing in its customer services. And what's happened is Ofgem, they were investigating Iressa anyway. And
I was going to say, this is not the first time, is it? There have been complaints about them, I think, which was in November. This is the second time Ofgem have looked at this company.
Yep. Exactly that. And that's not good enough. If you're constantly in the scope of a regulator, then it's not a very good sign.
Well, then what's the regulator doing? What are they doing? What can they do?
To be fair, they've stopped the company now from getting in new customers. Although saying that, yesterday, Rachel, our assistant editor, went through the Iressa website and it looked like you could sign up, so that was a little bit of a worry, but apparently they're not allowed to take any new customers on for an indefinite period. Ofgem have given them 3 months to get their act together. If they don't, they could have their energy license revoked. So basically just mean the company will cease to exist and people will just have to move to other suppliers. It'll be taken care of. They've got all sorts of, like, you know, safety nets and whatever. And it's inevitable, really, that you're going to get a lot of these little providers come up, and some of them may not quite cope, and you have to. So it's right. I'll reiterate this point. It's nothing really hugely to worry about. The biggest worry is for those that are currently having problems with ERASA and how that's going to be remedied. But I would suggest that if Ofgem are looking at this and you feel like things aren't going the way you want with the company, you know that something is being done. It's not like you are just a lonely voice, and they've got to probably get more staff in and start sorting this backlog out. I mean, Ofgem have said that customer emails need to be responded to ASAP, call waiting times need to come down significantly. All that means for ERASA is that they're going to have to take on more staff to sort these problems.
Okay, well, no one can accuse This Is Money of rubbish customer service. You guys help hundreds of readers with their issues. Many you offer up to the expert, and this is one such, our next item, one such example of this, and it's all about inheritance tax. Now, the email, which is sort of twinged with a bit of sadness, I think, actually, is a bit... It begins, this is the email, have decided to leave their house to their only granddaughter. For years it was left to me, but I am settled, housing-wise, and due to the cost of home ownership for the first-time buyers, they've changed their plans. However, my daughter has said it seems a little unfair on me, so she wants to split the inheritance two ways so we both get an equal share of their estate. Can this be done, and are there any tax implications? So, Simon, fill us in with more details, if you would. And who did you speak to? What was the advice?
OK, so before I fill you in with more details, I'll tell you something interesting about this story. This was a question that we had sent in to us by a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And as ever, with anything about inheritance, it garnered a substantial amount of comments. Now, many of the comments involved a bit of a pop at the person who'd asked the question, saying that they couldn't believe that this mother was going to take the inheritance off her daughter when her daughter was clearly in more need of it and the younger generation was struggling and she shouldn't even be thinking of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Two very interesting elements in that, okay? Firstly, the person who sent the question in is at no point identified as a woman, right?
Yeah. That is interesting.
And people are jumping to a conclusion that this is a mother talking about her daughter. It's not. It's a dad. It was a man who wrote this in.
How dare he take that money from his daughter?
Isn't that funny?
She said,
"Now
woman,
I don't know whether there's something about questions involving someone and their daughter that makes someone presume that. I don't know whether it's someone in the comments who first got the wrong idea, jumped to a conclusion, and then everybody else has jumped to it. Or I don't know whether this is kind of part of the slight underlying misogynism that you get in society. But it's quite interesting. It's quite interesting.
I thought it was a woman.
But I must admit, yeah, I think there's something about the question. But this is a genuine reader question. It was not. It was not sent in by a woman. It was sent in by a man. Secondly, he said he was quite amused by the comments when he'd read them, and also at no point does it say this in the question either that he wants this money. But he said, I have no desire for this money, no need for this money, and I'd much rather that my daughter kept it.
So why did he ask the question?
It's the daughter saying that she wants to split the money. So, which is interesting. I mean, I think, broadly speaking, in that scenario, the daughter should just stick with the grandparents' wishes, and particularly if her father says, look, I don't need the money, don't give it to me, just to hold on to it. Anyway, we got a reply to this from Liz Alley, Head of Financial Planning Operations at Brewin Dolphin. Now, she said, firstly, basically, the good news is there's probably no inheritance tax to pay because it's your parents' house. Everybody has a £325,000 inheritance tax allowance. You can double that up between a married couple or civil partners. So that's £650. This house isn't going to take them over it. The house is worth about £300. They also own a holiday chalet worth £15,000 and cash could be in the region of £40,000. So they're well within that limit. And there's also this new funny own home allowance that's going to eventually take up the inheritance tax up for a couple leaving a property to one of their direct descendants, which includes your grandchildren, to £1 million. So what can you do? Well, there are some tax implications involved in giving half of the share to someone. Firstly, if you take that house because it's been left to you in the will and then you sell that house, give half of the money to the other person, which is the the way most people would think of doing this, then there could be a gap between the date of death and the date of the property sale. If the value of the house goes up over that period, there is capital gains tax to pay. Not a lot of people realise this, that basically the change in the value of a property between the date of death and the date of sale for probate, and probate can take a while, does mean there is capital gains tax to pay. And there are ways of minimising that, and everyone has their own capital gains tax allowance. And if you've got a property that's gone up lots between those two dates, speak to a solicitor about it. They can help you deal with the scenario, a solicitor or an accountant. The other option that you have is something called a deed of variation. This is a legal thing that means that if you're left something in a will, you can actually divert that to someone else if you so choose, as long as you and all the other parties involved in the will, all the other beneficiaries involved, agree to it. You get a solicitor to draw this up. So it would be possible for the daughter in this instance to, after the death of her last surviving grandparent, to basically vary part of the estate that's been left to her, say 50%, and re-divert that to her dad. The benefit of that is that it doesn't involve the scenario where they would necessarily have to sell the property in order for half of it to go to someone else. It doesn't necessarily involve the gifting of half the property going to someone else and changing the title, which can have stamp duty implications as well. And it also means that there isn't this capital gains tax scenario. I mean, in this case, it's below the inheritance tax threshold, so it doesn't matter anyway. But you might want to do it if, for example, you are a parent and your parent dies, you yourself, would your estate would take you over inheritance tax, and you'd rather divert the money to the grandchild, your child. That's a much more common scenario.
I'm still thinking what my unconscious bias says about me, that I thought that that was a woman as well. The ISA deadline is fast approaching, so if you don't mind, let's go there if it's all right. You can stick a big old whack of money in these little saving numbers to keep the tax man's grubby hands off it. But you've not long now before the clock resets and we go again. But it's all a little bit fandangled now, isn't it? There isn't just one, but there are six types of accounts, each with their own rules about how much you can bung in, what you can invest, and when you can take the money out. So for a fuller explanation, we're not going to give you one now. Tough. You listen back to our ISA special. I think it was about 2 weeks ago. But Lee, isn't it a bit late?
Can I just say the ISA special was absolutely phenomenal, by the way. It covered everything. You should listen back
you
to that.
You weren't on it, though, were you?
I wasn't, but I listened to it, Georgie. No, yeah, I listened to it. Yeah, I'm not going to big myself up. Yeah.
I was like, it was you. Were you?
It was you, Simon and Rachel, and it was very, very good to listen. No, ISA's, we'll quickly touch on this because we did do the big special. It's not too late to get your button gear and get this sorted out. If you want to open an account or if you want to transfer, and I'm talking about cash ISAs here, the earlier the better, though. You've got until next Thursday. We've got Easter weekend obviously coming up, and any sort of things you get wrong in the paperwork or whatever, and it could delay or hold up the process, or it might mean that you just miss out on this year's £20,000 allowance. So the earlier you can get yourself sorted, the better. As you said there's a number of different ways that you can now save into an ISA. So you've got your cash ISA and your stocks and shares ISA, which have always been the two sort of bread and butter ISAs. We've got a number of other ones, sort of lifetime ISA now. It might be worth having a look into that if you're a bit younger and you want to save for a property or for retirement.
To £4,000.
Yeah, so yeah, it still gives you £16,000 a bit elsewhere if you're so lucky to have that kind of money laying around. Another one I'll touch about is the innovative finance ISA. Now, the key thing to point out about this is, unlike cash, where you've got FSCS protection up to 85 grand and stocks and shares where you've got up to 50 grand, the innovative finance ISA doesn't have that protection. It's a little bit more risky, but there's some good offers out there, especially for peer-to-peer providers, sort of your Zopas, Funding Circle. So have a look at those if you're interested in that. They're offering sort of 4% if you want to take that kind of risk. In terms of cash ISAs, it's been a little bit of movement the last couple of weeks. There's been some deals come out.
Upwards, very
slightly. Yeah, nothing massive, but still a little bit better than what we've seen before. Nothing that beats inflation, though, so unfortunately that's the thing, but you are getting that tax-free benefit, and as we keep pointing out, it's worth keeping, it's worth having, it's worth building up over the years. Nationwide have got a good one. It's a single access ISA, gives you access once over the year. If you've been a customer of Nationwide, any kind of product for a year, you get a bigger 1.4% rate. If you're a new customer or you've been with them for less than a year, it's 1.3%. Easy access wise, you've got Paragon and Shawbrook that offer 1.25%. And the 1 year fix states, you've got Al Ryan,
which is 1.5%, which is an Islamic bank, and it's a predicted rate, but it's always been met. It's a little bit different how they work it out. But if you're not happy with that, you've got Oak North that offers 1.47%. 2 year, there's three providers, Charter Savings Bank, Paragon and Principality. They're offering 1.67%. And if you want to fix for 5 years, we kind of recommend not really to do that. But for whatever reason, if you want to do that, you can get 2.25% with Charter Savings Bank, United Trust Bank, and interestingly, Halifax. Of a sudden popped out of nowhere and offering a 5 year fix at 2.25%.
Ladies and gentlemen, do not adjust the speed of your podcast. Lee is just super excited.
The reason why I point that out and make that into a thing is that is the first time
speaking really quickly then,
that
Lee.
A big bank,
yeah,
or you know, has actually come out really and got involved in anything to do with ISA. So perhaps, Georgie, perhaps when the clocks tick over to April 6th and the new tax year begins, maybe banks
just maybe
might start getting involved. Who knows?
No, come on, Lee. Let's not be ridiculous. No,
I always look on the brighter side of life, Georgia.
Don't you just...
I believe, I have hope that ISA season may rise from the ashes once more.
Well, you're excited then, Lee, I have to say.
No more
sweeties and e-numbers for you. but just to an update, if people haven't got a pen and paper in hand right now, where can they go to get the latest ISA deals and all that?
Well, I've got my roundup of five of the best ISAs, and we also have our full comprehensive independent cash ISA table on our savings page, which is thisismoney.co.uk/save.
And if you want to find the five of the best cash ISAs roundup picked by our very own Lee Boyce, go to thisismoney.co.uk/best-ISAs. And if you want to invest in an ISA, go to thisismoney.co.uk/ISA-investing. Don't leave it until the last minute. It is theoretically possible to do so until very late at night on the last day of the tax year, and some of the companies pride themselves on their ability to do this. But you could stumble at a number of points if you don't already have an investment ISA. Firstly, you might find that you don't manage to get through the whole sign-up process because of something to do with your address or things like that. They need to check you. And we all know how easy it can be to sometimes fail those things. Mm. You should also be able to get that money into your ISA or your pension, if you think about dealing with a pension, in time through the faster payments system. Your bank might have a limit on how much money goes through faster payments, but these things can go wrong. So if it really, really matters to you to get that money into your ISA or your pension in this tax year, do not leave it until the very last day. Start doing something about it now or over this weekend. Also, if you do invest your money into an ISA and you really want to use some of that allowance, what you can do is just pay it in as cash and just leave it in that investment ISA, that stocks and shares ISA, as cash. You don't have to make the investment decisions right now. You can make those investment decisions in the next tax year. As long as you get the money into the account, it counts as this year's allowance.
Fantastic. Finally, car sales. In Britain, are set to slide again this year amid a slowdown in consumer spending. The ratings agency Moody's says new car registrations likely to fall 5.5%, making the UK the worst performing market of any big European economy. As such, car dealers are said to be resorting to extreme measures in order to kickstart their poor sales figures and balance the books. But firstly, Lee, why the fall? Especially compared to other countries,
well,
going up.
Let's face it, over the years, the car sales have been steadily driving upwards. I just think that people are getting a little bit nervy about, you know, taking on finance, Brexit jitters a little bit.
Peak car, though?
But I always think about this. Just how many new cars there are on the road, you know, or nearly new cars. The last few years, very rarely see sort of old cars anymore. Anything sort of 10, 15 years plus, just nowhere near as much as what it used to be like. And a lot of that's down to a big finance, cheap finance boom, you know,
PPI.
Yeah, you know, PPI claims. Yeah, but honestly, people get it's a nice 5-6 grand. Let's put that towards a new car. A lot of people did do that, and that helped prop it all up. And also, we of course had Dieselgate. You know, in the last couple of years, diesel has been completely demonised. You know, we had the VW scandal. We've got the government cracking down.
New tax coming in.
You know, it's now more expensive to have a new car because of, you know, on the whole, because of the new tax changes. We had a new plate at the start of this month, and it doesn't seem like the appetite for a new plate has really sort of caught on. And for that reason, and reason that car sales are falling, they might be falling even more than we think, because it's likely that these dealerships are registering the cars before they're even sold.
What is pre-registering, Simon, and what are the car dealers up to? Why are they up to it?
Pre-registering is something that has been going on for years and that we've written about a number of times over the years. It is a slightly mystifying phenomenon that we've never quite got to the bottom of why they are willing to do this and quite how the financials work on it. Basically, car dealers have pretty low margins on new cars, and they tend to get paid by the car manufacturer for selling cars. So they'll have targets to hit, and if they hit those targets, they've got a nice big extra slug of money in, because car makers need people to keep selling cars because they're making lots of cars in a factory. So one trick that is employed in the trade, if car sales aren't going as swimmingly as possible, is to do this thing called pre-registration, where effectively the dealer becomes the first person registered on the car. So that counts as the car having been registered, which in car industry terms counts as that new car having been sold. They then have that car on the forecourt, and then they sell it to someone, and it effectively now becomes a used car. It's not a brand new car because someone else has been the first person on the registration. So in order to do that, that is actually less attractive to you, because what you want is a car where you're the first person on the registration, even if all of the evidence shows that that car never went anywhere whilst it was first registered. So it needs to be offered to you at a discount. Where this becomes slightly mystifying is the scenario where basically this involves people taking a hit on a car, and instead of leaving the car sat there waiting to sell it at a higher price, they do this pre-registration trick and then have to sell it at a lower price.
How desperate are they? And when you say lower price, what are you talking about here? Why are
they
so desperate?
Well, the biggest saving that we've got here listed in the top 10, we've got a 18% saving on an Audi A3 saloon, 1.6 TDI. And then also the Audi Q5 2-litre TDI Quattro Sport S-tronic, a 14.7% saving. What's interesting about those is those are pretty popular cars. I mean, we're talking about a premium car that people like. But, you know, the really tricky thing with new car pricing is there's the list price of the car and then there's what you actually pay for the car. And those two things are rarely the same. You can normally get pretty big discounts. And in this survey that we've got here, it just highlights the top 10. But even with non-pre-registered cars, you'll be able to get big discounts. And this research was done by buyacar.co.uk, a car buying service. But there's another service called CarWow, where you can get dealers to compete to offer you the best deal on the car. And you put in what car you want, and then the dealers say the best price they'll offer you. And I think most people operate on the basis that a car dealer is basically an agent of the car manufacturer, and so the deal that you'll get offered depends on what kind of deals the manufacturer is willing to offer at the moment. So if you walk into the car dealer in Epsom, for example, you'll get the same offer as you would if you walked into the car dealer in St Albans. And that's not true at all. Basically, different dealers will offer different discounts. So you might find that one dealer is willing to offer a 3% discount and another dealer is willing to offer a 10% discount. So it pays to keep your wits about you when you're buying a new car.
Shop around. Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, thank you very much. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.